In my head, I'm thinking, I literally dissect full legs, like from the hip down, and like I'm used to gangrene when I was working in vascular. Like, there's nothing that's going to disarm me. It was the smell that I was not ready for.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello and welcome back to the Adventure Stash, and welcome to potentially the most unique episode we've ever had. Certainly the most personal one. To some, this may be weird, but I hope that everyone that listens to this episode and the future part two, part three, part four that are inevitably going to come will understand why I felt the need to have my girlfriend on the podcast. Nicole Baker is someone that I've actually wanted to have on the podcast for years, since long before she and I were dating. She and I dating are a relatively recent thing, actually, a COVID phenomenon, as it were. But I've known of her and her exploits in all of the insane number of fields that she has thrown herself into for quite a few years, and known she'd be a great candidate for a while. And we've actually gotten some requests in the past for her, but since I've sort of made public our relationship, those requests have just gone through the roof. The holdup has actually been her desire to do it. She's incredibly shy, especially when it comes to talking about herself. And in large part, I don't blame her, because her story, her life story, is pretty unusual, not always uplifting, not always happy, but hands down, one of, if not the most impressive life story I have heard personally. So this first part deals with her medical professional background and her work as a coroner, which is highly interesting, and just starts to lay a little bit of groundwork. Just a quick synopsis, she is a sponsored athlete for mountain biking, particularly adventure mountain biking. She's sponsored by Yeti, Patagonia, Osprey Packs, just to name a few. She works in cancer diagnostics and started a charity that is based in Uganda, Africa, that we'll talk about more in future episodes. But there's so much to unpack here that we just have to spread it over a handful of episodes. So this is part one. There will be at least two more parts, and I'm really excited about one episode at a time, introducing you to probably the most impressive woman I've ever met. Hope you enjoy it. This episode is brought to you by Manscaped. There's definitely more than a little irony in that, since this week's guest is my girlfriend, but Manscaped has been a huge supporter of the show and a product that I've really enjoyed using and getting to know over the last couple of months. They have a whole handful of products that I'm using right now. Kind of their flagship offering at the moment is the Lawnmower 3.0, which is the most advanced hair trimmer I've ever used, the most advanced hair trimmer on the market. It has everything from a super powerful 7,000 RPM motor. It has an LED light that's really bright and allows you to see what you're doing regardless of how dark the environment is. It's waterproof, drop proof. I just absolutely love this thing. It has these really nice ceramic blades that are really gentle on even the most sensitive skin. Highly recommend this guy. Also, Manscaped has their all-new Shears 2.0, which is a nail trimming and grooming kit. Really high quality, comes in this super cool leather magnetic bound case. Very fancy looking and very fancy feeling, so that you can look fancy right down to your fingernails. If y'all are interested in giving Manscaped a try, you can use discount code PAYSON at checkout. That'll get you 20% off whatever it is you want to order and free shipping. Doesn't matter how much you order, It's 20% off everything and free shipping on everything. Just go to manscaped.com and use code Payson. Thank y'all for listening. Nicole Baker is finally doing my podcast because we're dating. She's my girlfriend, so she has to say yes. That's not true, but I think it's helping. You straight up don't want to do this. I'm not sure what changed your mind, but I'm very appreciative. First and foremost, we should quickly go over how it got to be that we're dating, because that's kind of funny. Because I've wanted to have you on the podcast long before we were dating. Basically, we're here because COVID happened. And we've known each other for, I think, 4 years, mostly via Instagram, run into each other a handful of times in town. But I'm finally in town long enough to get to know someone that also lives in town. And it's been a very rapid dating process, to say the least. And when you didn't really know much about me other than what you saw online, and I didn't know much about you other than what I saw online. But when we first started hanging out, our dating pretty much involved staying up until 2 a.m. with my jaw on the floor as you told me your life story slowly but surely. And I knew that you were someone that was really special, and I was really drawn to that. And strangely, I knew that I wanted other people to know more about you too, because you're, I think, in some ways the most impressive person that no one has heard of in a way. Like, you have 10,000 followers on social media. You have been in lots of high profile articles via your sponsors, Yeti, Patagonia, all that sort of thing. But that coverage isn't nearly enough based on all that you're up to. So with that groundwork laid, we're going to start from the beginning, because your story really only makes sense if your life story is told, I think. You did not grow up in Durango, Colorado. Where did you grow up?
I grew up all over the place. I was a military brat. My mom started in the military, and then she left the military when I was probably 4 or 5, and then she married someone in the military. So I kind of bounced around from military base to military base until high school. So I kind of grew up all over the place. I was born in North Carolina and lived in Quantico, Virginia, and Niagara Falls, and in Ohio, and spent a very short year in Yuma, Arizona. So it was kind of all over the place.
I know that you went to, I think I remember you saying 13 different schools, K through 12.
13, yes.
And did you go to college directly after that? What did you, because typically when someone graduates high school, there are some unknowns. Did you feel that at all? Did you have some sort of compass? Did you know that you immediately wanted to go to college and start studying something else?
This is going to sound really funny, but I never, I didn't know what I was going to do in college, but I knew that I had to go, and very quickly. I was very determined to not be struggling. My mom struggled a lot, financially, and I knew that I needed to go to school and come out with some sort of trade so that I could start making money as soon as possible. So I started at a community college, and I just started taking science courses, and I ended up in this funky physics course and was introduced to the idea of ultrasound, and I was a little bit of a physics whiz, and my physics instructor really wanted me to have a shot in vascular ultrasound, which is hemodynamics, our fundamental part of that type of ultrasound. And so I actually didn't even apply to the program that I started in. My professor kind of slid me in to an interview process, and I ended up in a vascular ultrasound program at the University of Michigan, and that's where I started.
Yeah.
That was my
intro
to science.
Yeah. And was that a paid thing or was that later? Because I know at one point you were doing research, which was, were you ever in a position education wise where you're also getting paid?
Definitely.
Okay.
So when I finished, so basically from the time I finished ultrasound school, I have been a chronic student all the way almost up in like a couple years ago, I've been taking classes. And that was all kind of leading off of whatever job I was working before. So when I switched into academic research, prior to that, I was working in ultrasound and going to school, and then ended up majoring in chemistry and biology, and then ended up also taking some statistics courses. And so I was in school, I was volunteering to a research program while working in ultrasound, and ended up kind of making a shift, almost finished with my undergrad, into a paid research position at the hospital. And from there, I kind of went off on the research tangent for, I say tangent, but it was 7 years.
Seven years of medical research you did.
Yes.
Yeah. So you did all of this research work, and you've brought out the binder that you have before of every every paper you've published. And when you publish a medical research paper, it goes into medical journals and becomes part of the incredibly vast database that informs how our medical world works. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
And this binder is huge.
It's a big binder.
It's a big binder. And you did all of this medical research. You contributed to our understanding of medicine by age what? How old were you?
My last paper was in 2014. So I would have been... You'll have to tell them why we're laughing. I guess I was 27 when I finished my last research paper. Sorry.
That math is wrong.
That math is wrong.
It's okay.
I was 29. It's late and I've had a glass of wine.
No, you haven't. You've had like a quarter of a glass of wine. You're so far behind me.
Yeah, 29. Not 27.
Okay. So a relationship brought you to Durango. And you started work at Mercy Regional Medical Center, which is mm-hmm. the big hospital, our big regional hospital that's based here in Durango. It's kind of funny because you're a physician's assistant, technically.
Pathologist assistant. Yes.
Technically, which doesn't require nearly as much school or qualifications as you have. Is that fair to say? Like, you're insanely overqualified?
To be doing pathology assisting?
Yeah.
I would say
in terms
that.
Of, like, the breadth of things you've studied.
I've got a very diverse education and experience level, but basically a pathologist assistant is an anatomist. And, you know, in very, very simple terms, my... experience that I've had within all of my jobs is all kind of related to anatomy. So it was a very easy transition, if that's what you're saying. And I've definitely been through a lot more schooling than just being an anatomist, but
that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Okay. Yeah.
So what do you do now? Cause there will be people that don't know what pathology is.
So pathology is the study of diseases, and my job is to work under the supervision of a pathologist. And I guess the largest role that I have at the hospital right now is tissue dissections within anatomic pathology, which is basically anything that is removed from the body, makes its way to the pathology lab and sees me. And my involvement with that tissue varies greatly on what we're looking for. But I guess a very easy explanation of what I do would be if you were a female, actually could be male too, and you had a mass that you felt in your chest or breast, and you went in and had a mammogram. I say that it can happen in males too, because it's not impossible for a male to develop a breast cancer. But so a mammogram would show an abnormality in the chest, and then a biopsy would be taken of that site. The biopsy would make its way to me, and we would put it through, I guess, a processor that makes it so that a slide can be made. And then we look at those, we look at that tissue under the microscope, and then we look to see if that tissue is normal or abnormal. And at that point, we give the information to the surgeon and to the radiologist, and they decide whether they want to continue the path with the patient. And so if it was a cancer that we had seen, we would either receive a lumpectomy or a mastectomy. And so a mastectomy is the complete removal of the breast. And when that happens, that also makes its way to me. And I basically do a very extensive tissue dissection to look at any abnormality and its relation to the surrounding tissue. And that is the basis for staging of cancers. So, and sometimes we'll get lymph nodes as well, which also contributes to the staging process of tissue. And then we do that with basically every tissue type that you can think of. So I get kidneys, and I'll get an entire, you know, long segment of a colon,
a leg
sometimes. And
so you're basically, you get a piece of a person.
Yes.
And you determine whether there is cancer there or not.
Yes. And not just cancer. Sometimes it's, we're looking for inflammation. Like if someone has an appendicitis and the surgeon removes the appendix, it's my job to basically say, yeah, the surgeon didn't just take the appendix for no reason. There's inflammation there.
Yeah. During COVID.
Oh boy.
The resources to do your job have been limited. Your hours got reduced for a period of time, way reduced. Regardless of where you stand, maybe you're someone that's staying really, really informed, doing everything you can to be responsible, or maybe you're on the other end of the spectrum and you don't believe in wearing a mask. You think that it's way overblown, that sort of thing. I really want people to be able to hear what it's like to be working at a hospital right now in a position where you shouldn't be dealing with COVID at all, and how it's impacting your job and the people whose lives you're trying to save. So first of all, I want to set a little bit of groundwork that your position very, very legitimately is the difference between, like, you making a mistake can cost someone their life. If you don't catch that there's cancer and they're sent home and further action isn't taken, they absolutely could die. That could be the difference between them living and dying. You come home all the time and say, hey, I had a really good day at work because I saw something that no one else saw, and now an intervention is taking place that is saving this person's life. So I want it to be very clear that what you do every day very literally is saving people's lives. Because of COVID, because of the strain that COVID is putting on just your hospital, the Mercy Regional Medical Center in Durango, Colorado, because of the strain that that's putting on your hospital, which you came home and told me the other day, all beds were full. Mercy was starting to fly people to a hospital in New Mexico because there were no more beds available because everything was taken up by COVID patients. In that scenario, and I'm going to let you take over here in a minute, in that scenario, cancer treatments have been deemed elective, which means they get cut. People who have cancer are being told, sorry, we don't have the resources to deal with you. People who have cancer, because there are so many COVID patients, people who have cancer are being told, sorry, we can't help you, and they're going home and dying. Is that fair to say?
No.
Okay.
I know what you're trying to say, which is very, very sweet. Patients aren't... So right now, with the... So when we were... When elective surgeries were being pushed off was when COVID kind of went crazy. It was when basically we were on complete lockdown back in March. When that happened, basically anything that was not considered... life-threatening in that moment was pushed off. So, for instance, like a GI biopsy, like the GI laboratory wasn't doing their screenings where you would potentially pick up a cancer. And patients that were, I guess we were getting some breast biopsies, but a lot less. I think people were kind of being pushed away to come in for surveillance-type studies. And that was when, that was back in March. And what I think you're remembering is that, unfortunately, a decision was made when elective surgeries were kind of pushed off that that said that if a patient had a specific type of breast cancer, and that type of breast cancer is a tumor that is present with estrogen receptors, if those patients could be treated with a chemotherapy drug... which is tamoxifen, they were not surgically removing those tumors. And so we went, how long was that? How long was that lockdown? Was it I think it was 2 months. I think it was a solid 2 months that we were seeing close to nothing. I was working 2 hours a day. We weren't seeing our typical cancer cases. And it was basically because they were being treated in another way and surgeries were considered elective unless they were a very, very small subset of cancers. So there were a few, I did get a few different surgery cases that were like major surgeries, but truly most of our big cases were pushed off. And what that ended up meaning was that when elective surgeries opened back up, we were seeing pretty advanced diseases. And we can't technically 100% blame COVID, but I feel that most of these patients being treated earlier would have resulted in a less aggressive cancer that would have saved some lives. But that's my own opinion. And I definitely cried a few days when I went back to work, when we started seeing surgeries again, just because I kind of had this just... feeling that these really advanced diseases that I was seeing could have been prevented had there been different, I guess, criteria for what was considered elective. And, you know, the same can be said for so many diseases. We were seeing appendicitises that were ruptured, and fallopian tubes where a patient, you know, an ectopic pregnancy where someone was probably experiencing pain long before they came into the hospital with a rupture, that, you know, people were just afraid to come into the hospital because of COVID. And then cancer patients were literally told, you know, depending on what they were being treated for, that that there were these alternative methods for treating. And then bigger than that, you've got all of these screenings that we do that are very important that were just completely pushed off. So yeah, right now we're seeing cases that just feel like they're far more advanced than they should be. And the current situation with COVID now, you know, back in the peak in March, we weren't even really seeing cases in Durango. And now we are. We're seeing those cases, and we're still able to perform elective surgeries, but our volume is still decreased, and patients have to kind of jump through hoops to get elective surgeries. So in that way, you know, there definitely are still delays with treatment. And we do have, I think the exact scenario that you're probably referring to is one of the days that we had our entire ICU full of COVID patients. We had one of our radiology nurses was pulled out of radiology to go and help up in that ICU. And so, you know, the exams that she should have been assisting with were postponed. And we had no idea how long that was going to happen. We have a big shortage in qualified good nurses. And, you know, we're a small hospital. And we're definitely, I actually don't know what the number of patients that we have right at the second is, but we were definitely at capacity not that long ago.
Yeah. Anyone that's a nurse, Durango wants you.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Glad we clarified that. I want to address another wrinkle. Another amazing dark alley in the life of Nicole Baker.
Oh God.
In regards to dealing with human dissection, your job now isn't the only thing you've done. You were the deputy coroner.
Oh boy.
of the area for a while.
Yes.
Which, just quickly give us a definition. What is that?
So deputy coroner, works under the supervision of the coroner, and basically, I was training to and taking calls, at night, for any subjects that, I guess had passed away, that needed some sort of investigation as to how they died. So basically, coroners are involved in most deaths that are not, where the patient isn't fighting a known illness that can be documented in a medical record. So anyone young, any car accidents, any suicides, any... any
homicide.
Yeah, definitely homicide. So you would go to the site and perform an assessment of the subject and determine a time of death, and then ask the appropriate questions to anyone that is on site, and then
police officers, emergency personnel, that's who would be on site, right? Typically?
Sometimes it's family. I'm kind of, the coroner is called not late in the game, but it's usually, you know, police or ambulance or firefighters that are called first, and they don't call us until they know the subject has died. And then once that happens, there's kind of this separation and role between a person that is the coroner who's looking at the body and then the police officers who are dealing with the site. And those two areas do not intersect. So the police officers are not going to be touching the body, and I'm and I'm not touching evidence that's off of the body. So the
you
coroner...
You get to deal exclusively with the body.
Yeah. And it sounds a lot more interesting than it is, but for the most part, you're showing up and you are doing an assessment of the clothing and the body, and basically trying to see any details that you think will be important once you get the body to the morgue. And then it's that person's role to, like, the coroner is actually putting the body into the, I'm going to call it the body bag. I'm sure it's, there's probably a better way for me to describe that, but
moving into... Well, how would you refer to it?
The body bag.
Yeah.
It's a big, big plastic fluid type.
Just like you bag. See on CSI.
Yes. And then you basically get the body into the body bag, load it onto a stretcher, push it into the coroner truck, and load it to the morgue. And you are also... there's a questionnaire that you're answering if there's any family members or anyone around. And, yeah, you go to the site of the accident. So it's kind of, yeah, you're at the site of death for the subject.
And a lot of times you literally are the only one loading the body into the body bag, right? You
didn't, yes.
You would show up to these scenes, a young female, exclusively with the job of loading the body into the body bag without any help, right? You had no colleagues in this. And the reason I'm saying this is because you just sort of touched on the dynamic between sometimes the emergency personnel, whether it be police officers, firefighters, whatever, which oftentimes, traditionally speaking, are male.
Yeah.
Frequently. And you're this young lady loading a body into a body bag. And we haven't talked about it too much, but you sort of have touched on how that was a weird dynamic sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. I think...
Since, like, loading bodies into body bags is not a weird dynamic to begin with.
Yeah, that was... It was definitely an odd... I remember when I was asked if I wanted to train... to do that job, I remember thinking, well, of course I have to say yes. I mean, yes, I have to see what this is. and I had thought with my background that I would actually be pretty, I don't want to say good at it, but I thought that I'd be able to remove myself from the emotional attachment to the patients, but that wasn't the case. But yeah, I think when you show up to a site and you're dealing with this human that you can very much see was alive, very recent to that time. It's definitely challenging. I think I wasn't doing it long enough to really experience the dynamics with the police officers and the firefighters, but I had heard a lot of stories because there's another deputy coroner that is female, and then our coroner, Jan Smith, is also female. And it's, you know, definitely they had told me times where they'd go down to the river and have to pull a body out of the river and not have help from the staff that was out there. Myself, I did experience a little bit of that, but I think it was more maybe not even pride. I just didn't know really how to ask for help. But yeah, it was definitely an odd little phase of my career in pathology.
Can you quickly describe the first case that you were on? Are you comfortable doing that?
I don't know if I should.
Okay.
Just because it's public.
It's public record.
It's public record. I think I can.
Because I'm just wanting to add a little bit of color. Because I don't know. I just feel like, to a degree, there's an obligation to tell those stories because there are heroes out there who do this every day, and it's not a TV show.
Yeah,
Like, it's not fake blood, and it's not a Hollywood backdrop, and it's not CGI. You know?
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
I think, yeah, that's a good point. And you're right. Jan Smith, our coroner, who's been there for so, so long, is a saint for what she has seen and experienced, being the coroner in Durango. I did not last very long. And the case you were talking about, I'm going to very quickly blow over, but was a young adult who had been in a motorcycle accident, who had been speeding, and he basically crashed his motorcycle, and in the process had lost his leg, and the force of losing his leg kind of turned the bike over to the other side, and he lost his other leg, and he passed away in the street. And when coroner staff arrived,
being you by yourself, right?
Yes.
The way you say things sometimes. When coroner staff arrived, aka me.
No, I don't know. This is such a gnarly story. Basically, body parts had to be collected, and because police officers are legally not allowed to be involved in that process, you're picking up body parts, and that particular case, the police officer had said, the right lower extremity is X and the left lower extremity is X. And,
it's over here and over there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And it was gnarly because this person's friends were on site, very emotional. And you're just kind of there, asking questions and cleaning up, and it's a site that I can say that I have never had never really been exposed to. I'd seen bodies before starting to work with the coroner, between, you know, either watching or assisting in autopsies, and actually doing deputy work. But yeah, it's gnarly work, and definitely not for me. I thought that I would be able to do that work. But turns out when you're working, I'm working full time as a PA, and
yeah. Why in the world did you do this? And how long did you do it?
Oh gosh. 8 months.
Okay. And why? I mean, you have a job that supports you plenty well to live a comfortable lifestyle. Why did you sign up for this thing where, I mean, my understanding is you were on call in the middle of the night. So you would very often get a call in the middle of the night. Your phone would go off, and you knew that when your phone went off, you had to get up, get dressed, and go pick up a body and put it in a body bag. Why were you doing that?
Well, it didn't start quite like that. This is how this started. I haven't told you this story. So there.
Yay! Finally, something I don't know.
Something you don't know. I learned about these autopsies happening because we were contacted to see if we would process the tissue at the lab. And I didn't really know what it entailed, but, you know, and we actually are not paid for processing the tissue. And it's just something that we're doing because it's not a ton of slides and it's not a big deal. But it was when we started receiving blocks of tissue that this sweet little old man, another deputy coroner by the name of George, would come into the hospital. And George was a talker. And he'd come in and he always would see, he'd walk in and he would see me performing a dissection. And he just wanted to talk. He's just kind of...
He was probably... When you say he was a talker, he was probably just a talker towards you. Is my guess, but that's a difference.
Oh, no, I think anyone that knows George thinks he's a talker. He's just he's the sweetest man. But he would come in and not interrupt me, but he was just kind of interested in what I was doing. And, you know, it was very similar to what he was seeing with autopsies. And we slowly kind of became friends as he would bring tissue from these from these autopsies. And one day he was just like, you know, we could really use some help down at the coroner's office. You know, I'm a deputy, but I'm not going to be here very long. And, you know, you'd probably be great at it. And he basically...
You're great at cutting open human bodies.
He was so sweet. But anyway, he was like, we could use some help. And I was just kind of... fascinated by the fact that we had a forensics pathologist in Durango. And really, with me not going through a PA program, I missed the aspect of grad school, like the months that you would spend working in autopsies. So I was like, I should absolutely go get experience doing this. So I, and at the time, I was working 4 10-hour days. And I was working, my days off would rotate between Wednesdays and Fridays. And Wednesdays are autopsy day. So every other Wednesday on my day off, I would head over to Hood Mortuary, to the basement, and I would watch these autopsies. And, you know, even that was a little hard. The first one that I walked into, I was a little embarrassed because they all told me. It's very different. So the environment that I work at the hospital, tissue is preserved in formaldehyde or formalin. I'm also in this negative airflow chamber hood that kind of sucks out any smells that you could experience, putting it delicately. And then when I went to my first autopsy, they told me, you know, just if you need to sit down, sit down. And there's a chair in the room. And I remember, you're laughing, but they said that.
I see body parts all the time. Why literally, would I need to sit down?
In my head, I'm thinking, I dissect full legs, like from the hip down. And like, I'm used to gangrene when I was working in vascular, like there's nothing that's going to disarm me within this job. And then I walked in and there were two bodies on two different stretchers, and one had already had its autopsy and was in the process of being embalmed. And then next to it was a patient who, a subject that they had just basically open. Received. No, actually, you're right. And that, so it was the patient that was being embalmed that was so striking to me. So I could see, I guess with autopsies, you have the chest cavity is opened and the skull is cut into so that you can look at the brain. And with this particular case, he was not completely put back together. The subject closest to me, subject number two, was fully dressed, and we were about to start the assessment of the clothing when I walked in. And the smell, it was the smell that I was not ready for. I guess the appearance of a, you know, human. It was disturbing, but it was the smell that really, I guess, made me feel like maybe I could have used that chair, but being the stubborn human that I am, I was not about to sit in the chair in front of the staff members that I was trying to tell them, well, like, this is what I do, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So I stood and I tried to increase my blood pressure by taking deep breaths and holding it in. I do that
sometimes when I'm on a dusty road and a car passes me.
Yeah, that's a good tactic. But, you know, I was thinking about vascular, like, you increase the pressure. Like, I was just hoping to stay up because I was starting to feel a little lightheaded.
Oh, really?
And so I...
Because of the smell more than what you saw.
Well, the smell, I wasn't trying to stop the smell. I was trying to stop myself from passing out. The smell, yeah. I felt tingles throughout my entire body when I walked in the room, and I was very, not embarrassed, but I thought, like, what if I hit the ground right now? Like, what if I actually pass out? They're going to be like, yep, another one hits the dust. Or bites the dust.
So do you think there's anything programmed there from a human standpoint? Like the smell of another, like of a deceased human, or do you think it's just purely it smelled so bad that it was overpowering?
It was just overpowering. Okay. It's like you have, I mean, some of these subjects, I mean, I saw a lot of autopsies. Some of these subjects maybe had been deceased for a few days before they were found. Maybe their neighbor called, mm-hmm. or maybe, you don't know how long the body has been in its place before you are there. And,
was there anything, sorry, just to interrupt again, but was there anything overwhelming about seeing the subjects, like the actual
absolutely.
Visual?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
The visual was shocking, but I kind of had prepared myself for that. Like, I knew we're going to dissect this. A chest, which is not something that, you know, I get like a kidney or I get a breast or I get a colon or a leg. I've never cut into a human body. And so I knew that that was going to be new and potentially, you know, a little odd. And so I had prepared myself for that. I'd thought about it and visualized it and expected to walk in and just, you know, look at the body as a learning module. I mean, that's what I was doing. I was there to learn what it is that you look for in an autopsy. And I thought if I just focused on each specific body part, it would make me feel at home in the laboratory. It sounds so stupid, but that's what I was doing. I was just like,
just this time we're all connected.
Now we're in the chest. Stare at the lungs, Nicole. Stare at the lungs. But the smell, I don't want to, it is, I don't know if I, like, we're still talking about the smell.
Anyway.
The smell is decomposing body bowel that has now become, you know, necrotic with stool in it. And you cannot begin to imagine what decomposing body and rotten stool smells like all combined in a little small room without ventilation. Basically over a table that you can run water into. It's very raw, I guess, is the word to use for it. And I was embarrassed that I was affected by it in the way that I was. So I just, like, got super serious and just focused very much on, in my head, I was just thinking, focus on Dr. Arnold's words and, you know, look at the organs, not the body. But, you know, at the point, that first autopsy was so interesting to me because I was learning that every subject we are looking at as if it could be a homicide. And even though it may look one way, it might be another way. So the things that these seasoned people were telling me to look for, which is, you know, look at their clothing. Does it look like they put on their clothing? Are their jeans buttoned? Is that the way you would put on your pants, or did somebody else dress this person? And the way you're looking at this subject just kind of changes the way you're thinking about an examination completely. Where I'm looking for disease, you're looking at possible intent, possible homicide. And
that's crazy.
Yeah, it was a little odd. And I heard lots of stories by Dr. Arnold kind of explaining, you know, just some kind of insane cases that he had seen in New York. And I think, you know, they did need help. And to me, I call myself a yes person. I like to say yes to as many things as I can, because I feel like having a more diverse subset of experiences goes a lot further than kind of staying on a linear path. And that's very obvious by my very erratic career path choices. But I definitely appreciate the time that I spent doing that. But I can very confidently say that I'm not meant to be a career coroner.
But you went back after that first experience because were you intrigued by kind of the detective work in a way, or?
Honestly, I was probably more motivated by the fact that I had a problem with it. Like, the fact that I was kind of almost, you know, like I almost had to sit down, that I kind of wanted to challenge myself to figure out why, and is that something that I can get past mentally? And I wanted to help, and I thought it was a great learning opportunity. And the detective work part of it, it was...
You didn't want it to... That's so interesting. You didn't want it to beat you.
Yeah. And I felt like, and still a little bit, I say this, and you might have to deal with me in like a year when, if I get asked to help again, I might give it another go, but I...
No. No. Because I'm not okay. I'm not okay with the scenario in which your pager or phone goes off or whatever, and you're like, sorry, gotta go load bodies into body bags, and then you slip back into bed at like 3:30, and I'm just going to be wondering, okay, what did that one look like?
No, you wouldn't. You, that would make your life a little bit more exciting.
No, Ray is already waking us up as is. I'm sorry. Nicole, you don't need more on your plate. Right now, people are already thinking, oh my gosh, how has she done so much? This is like chapter 2 of 100. We're not even scratching the surface. They'll understand. Point being, no. I know it's not my decision, but my input is no more deputy coroner work. speaking of the detective component real quickly. So I would love to hear as much as you can, because of HIPAA guidelines, talking about the truck driving case.
Oh, that one was so cool.
Yeah, because it is, that's where this work is kind of like the movies and really, really fascinating.
Yeah, this is, I do love this story because it is one of, I don't know what case that was for me. It was very near the beginning. But there was a truck driver in near the Silverton area that had crashed his truck, like a work vehicle, and basically tumbled down the mountain pass and was crushed by his truck, and then brought...
Which pass was this?
I think it was up... It was like leading down into Silverton.
So Red Mountain?
No.
Like coming down Mullis.
Coming down Mullis, yeah.
Holy cow. That's not a place you want to go off the side.
No, it was gnarly. And, you know, the question was why it wasn't snowy. There was no reason for him to have been in a car accident. And, but his cause of death, to me, I remember thinking, like, again, this was in the very beginning, thinking, what in the world are we doing this for? Like, of course we know his cause of death. He was crushed by his truck. Like, this is insane. they had to basically peel him out of the vehicle. And when he came in for his autopsy, I remember just kind of standing by Dr. Arnold and just like wondering, what in the world are you going to tell me other than the fact that this man is very beat up by his vehicle? And basically, what we had found was a lot of blunt trauma. And then during the brain dissection, we could see trauma again, but there was an area of the brain that appeared to have a different, it looked, I guess the trauma looked different. It looked, it was a darker blood. It actually looked like it was there longer than the remaining, sorry, not the remaining, the other traumas to the brain. And we took some tissue from the brain in that area. And then we took some from a very clear external trauma that he had had to his brain. And I took the tissue with me to Mercy, and we processed the tissue and ran a special test to look for hemosiderin, which is basically a test that looks for an older blood clot. So hemosiderin starts to form after a longer period of time than like your traditional blood clot. There's different phases of a blood clot in the clotting process. And basically what we discovered was that the clot that was in the frontal aspect of the brain had been there much longer than the rest of the injuries. And to me, I was thinking, well, that's odd. But what was discovered was that this man had been in some sort of, essentially, I think it was concluded that it was a bar fight with someone that he actually knew, and he had been hit in the head by a beer bottle. And that beer bottle smack had caused a slight injury to his brain, and he had a very slow brain bleed that did not really affect him until it caused a stroke while he was driving, which caused the vehicle to go off the side of the road. And I remember just being completely blown away by the fact that we could test for that, and that we were a part of that type of investigation. And I think that story, like being involved in that case, led to Dr. Arnold, who has all of this experience for years and years and years. I think he had, I really want to say more than 20 years of experience as a forensics pathologist, had told me all these like crazy stories of strange pathologic findings during the autopsy that changed the course of investigation for that subject. And it was fascinating to me. I definitely was interested. I just wasn't sure to what extent I would actually be able to emotionally handle being involved in those cases.
Yeah, and just to finish that specific storyline, that finding changed the legal ramifications of what happened.
Yeah.
Basically, my understanding is the guy that had hit this individual in the head with the beer bottle was charged with homicide, right?
Manslaughter.
Manslaughter. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Duh. Manslaughter. Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Basically, this person was charged with being responsible for this guy's death.
Yeah.
Do you think that's right?
You know, it's...
I mean, it's the law, but do you think it's right?
It's hard to say. Like, that same scenario. I wasn't involved in this case, but I saw the autopsy of another subject, and it was kind of this another crazy case where it was another bar fight type of scenario, and he had been punched in the nose by a friend. And I forget the story. They had the story. I think it was something as silly as he called the man that had died, had called his friend a fat idiot or something like that. And his friend popped him in the face of the bar. And this man was an alcoholic and he had liver issues and other health issues. And basically, because of that, his clotting factors weren't appropriate. And he ended up bleeding internally and died in the middle of the night. And that is another really tough case of, you know, involuntary manslaughter where it wasn't intentional. And
that guy was charged also with involuntary manslaughter.
He was. And I don't actually know what the results of those cases were, but it is the law. And it's something to keep in mind. I mean, not that we walk around getting in bar fights, but like, you know, if your hands lead to the death of someone, and it could be, you know, you could look at that as, you know, a driver that hits a cyclist. He didn't mean to hit the cyclist, but texting led him off the road and he killed somebody. Somebody has to be held accountable if it's an accident like that. And unfortunately, I think we can all empathize with the fact that, like, I mean, I've never been in a bar fight, but like, I can imagine plenty of scenarios where you pop your friend in the head and it's just, you expect them to come, you know, to breakfast the next day with a funny story of being like, hey, like,
remember last night,
and the person dies, and then you have that on your shoulders. And yeah, there's a lot of cases like that in the short period of time that I was working in Durango. Yeah, there were two cases that were very similar to that. And yeah, it's unfortunate. I don't know if I won't say that I disagree with it, but it's definitely a tough thing to.
It's sort of a weird, this might be a major stretch, but it sort of reminds me of the pro-life versus abortion topic, where it's kind of like, where at one point is life, is it a human life? Like, where on the spectrum of conception versus a child being born, like, where is that line drawn?
Yeah.
And in a way, it's like, where is death drawn? Is when the first domino is tipped over, is that where death starts?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing to think about, because you could just as easy blame his liver.
Exactly.
Which, you know, was failing because of his alcoholism.
Like, do you, again, it could be a stretch, but do you stretch it back to like the abusive home life that drove him to be an alcoholic?
Yeah, I think that would be very, a lot more complicated
to
determine than this is the impact that led to the blood that killed this patient bleeding.
Yeah. It's just an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, I can remember when they were telling me about these stories, just kind of wondering, man, like, do you feel some responsibility to be the person that uncovers that information?
Interesting.
I think the general consensus is it's your job. You can't think about, you know, someone's emotional place or whether you agree with what happened or whether you can empathize, because I think we can empathize with a whole lot of scenarios. You just have to look at what you're seeing and provide that information. And then luckily it's not up to the coroner to chase that information. It was ultimately the police officers that had to dig into, like, well, why did he have, why was he bleeding before the accident? And it's just this kind of team event that kind of leads to the official cause of death of a subject.
We're going to tie this up, but lastly, we very obviously don't need to go into details here, but can we quickly touch on why you stopped doing this work?
The coroner work?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just,
because my understanding is there was an event.
Yeah, there was an event. I stopped because it became too personal for me, and I realized that maybe I didn't have what it would take to do that type of work in a small town where I could potentially know a subject and need to be involved in that process. And I did have an event happen that I was more involved with than I wanted to be. And that actually wasn't my last case, but it kind of started me down the path of like, you know, this is like, what's the end goal here? Do I want to continue to take call at night? Do I eventually want to run to be possibly elected as the coroner? And the answer to that was no. And it's not that there's still so much that I could learn. You know, I was in there for a very short period of time. But for me, I think I can very easily identify as just a very overly empathetic person. And I think that Durango is just a very, very small town, and I want a little bit more separation to accidents that happen in Durango.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well said. So, we didn't get as far as I thought we might, and I knew we were going to move slowly.
Oh, boy.
But that was awesome, I think. thank you, Nicole. It's crazy to me how much we've covered and how far we have to go. The next time we talk, I'd like to get into when your life started to go international and why, and how you became an international woman of mystery on adventures far and wide. And we'll start with experiences in Haiti that potentially could have enormous ramifications. Hopefully we won't get sued because you're going to blow the lid on some kind of crazy stuff.
Uh-huh.
Too bad we're 2 hours and 20 minutes in, because I'd like to talk about it already, but it's really late and I'm tired.
I'm tired too.
Until next week when we travel.
Next week.
When we travel to Haiti.
Wait a minute.
What?
Next week.
Yeah, this is a series. This is Nicole Baker's series. You didn't know that?
I knew that we were maybe going to do more than one, but I thought like 3 months from now, then we
These are coming one after the other. That's the only way that, yeah, that's the only way this is going to work.
You purposely did not disclose that information.
No, I 100% thought you knew that. That's the, I mean, heck, I would love to release them one day after the other.
Oh, boy.
Or I would love to make it, no, that wouldn't work, but.
Interesting.
Do you feel deceived?
With that smile, I can't quite say that I feel deceived. But considering you asked me just yesterday, that's when you said that we were going to do this.
Give me a break.
You've been asking me for
years. Literally.
Okay.
So, like I said, next week, Nicole Baker takes us to Haiti and takes down an enormous, nasty, evil company. Until then, good night. Thank you all for listening, and thank you to Manscaped for sponsoring this episode.
Manscaped has everything you need to look good and feel good, whether that be hair trimming with their Lawnmower 3.0, nail hygiene and caretaking with their Shears 2.0 kit, or it could be just something as simple as getting clean, washing your hair, washing your body with their Crop Cleanser. Their Crop Cleanser is something that I have in my shower right now, actually. It's my go-to. Smells great, doesn't have any weird ingredients in it. Use it every single day. I don't use their Lawnmower 3.0 every day, but I use it every week, and it's been just purring away. It's proven really durable, consistent, and delivers exactly what I need it to in regards to a hair trimmer. It has a really powerful 7,000 RPM motor, an LED light that makes it possible for you to see even in the darkest corners of your shower or bathroom or wherever you happen to be doing your grooming. If you would like to check out manscaped.com and get yourself some of these wonderful products that I currently am enjoying, you can use code PAYSON at checkout for 20% off and free shipping. It doesn't matter how big your order is. If you want to, you could order one of everything and you still get 20% off that order and free shipping on all of that stuff. Pretty damn good deal if you ask me. Just go to manscaped.com and use code PAYSON. Thank you to Lily for editing and producing this show and honestly handling all of the increasingly complicated back end stuff that I don't have time for. She does all of the dirty work, all of the thankless work, and does it each and every week so that we have this show delivered to your ears each and every week. Thank you, Lily, for being such a solid partner in this podcast adventure. And thank you all for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for leaving a rating or a review. All of those things go a long way. If you listen on iTunes, if you're not subscribed, the newest episodes likely won't pop up until 24 hours after they're actually published. It's kind of an annoying, weird quirk that I don't really understand the reason for, but just something to keep in mind. If you listen on Spotify or any of the other platforms, nothing to worry about. Thank you all for listening, and we will catch you next week with part 2 of Nicole Baker.